Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Live from North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. My name's Emma Revel, Head of Communications at the IEA, and this week we're discussing Sub-Saharan Africa, the world's poorest region, and looking at what we can expect from the continent in the 2020s. In the year 2000, The Economist magazine described Africa as the hopeless continent, adding that the new millennium has brought more disaster than hope to Africa. But the continent has some of the youngest and most vibrant populations in the world, so have the first two decades of this millennium panned out in the way The Economist predicted? Today, I'm joined by Alexander Hammond, Policy Advisor to the Director General here at the IEA, and a Senior Fellow at African Liberty, who strongly disagrees with The Economist's sombre diagnosis. Alex thinks far from being hopeless, Africa will embrace rapid growth within the next decade, thanks in part to a new free trade area that's supposed to be implemented later this year. So, Alex, you've written prolifically on Sub-Saharan Africa and the progress that's been made in the last 20 years. Can you give our listeners a quick overview of the continent's success?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on. In the last 20 years, growth in Africa has been quite rapid. Of course, it's got a long way to go, but that shouldn't ignore the fact that there's been substantial progress. So if we look at GDP, for example, gross domestic product, in the last 20 years, Africa's GDP has more than tripled. Average incomes adjusted for inflation and purchasing power have more than doubled in the last 20 years. And besides economic measures, things like infant mortality rates are more than halved. Literacy rates have increased by about 8%. And of course, 8% might not sound like a lot, but that's equivalent to another 136 million people being able to read and write now than at the beginning of the millennia. Similarly, life expectancy has increased by 10 years over a 20-year period.
That's astonishingly impressive, isn't it?
Yeah, that essentially equates to every single day that goes by, life expectancy increases by about 12 hours. And for many people, that'd be the difference between knowing their grandchildren or not, or dying before they are alive. And what we've seen is the countries that are liberalised the most have actually done the best in the last 20 years.
Okay, so when we look at the reasons behind the improvements, it's economic freedom, social freedom. How has this come about?
Yeah, so most of the progress on the continent has actually only really occurred since the late 1990s. And has largely coincided with more economic liberalisation. Marion Tupi, who's editor of humanprogress.org, which is a great website, I recommend all listeners check it out. He's noted before that after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the USSR, much of socialism lost its appeal across the continent. And without the USSR propping up these socialist dictators, many of the countries began to slowly open themselves up to trade from the rest of the world. And going forward into the 2020s, that looks like it will be increasing over time.
When people talk about free trade, they don't usually think of Africa as the first place. They're thinking about trade with the United States, for example, or with China. Mm-hmm. What's changed to reprioritize Africa as a sort of free trading hub?
Yeah, so in 2018, the African Union, which is a community of 55 African countries, launched its African Continental Free Trade Area. It opened the agreement up for signatures. And in last year, after enough countries had ratified the agreement through their domestic governments, it has entered its operational phase, which essentially means it's now in its planning stage. And later this year, it is meant to be implemented fully. So far, 54 of the 55 African countries have signed on.
Who's holding out?
It's Eritrea, who is sometimes... Critics sometimes harshly call it the hermit kingdom of Africa. So 54 have signed and 29 countries have ratified it. There's still a long way to go before 54 have ratified it. And once the free trade area is implemented later this year, that means 90% of tariffs on goods traded between African countries will immediately be removed. And then they plan for by 2030, another 7% of tariffs will be removed. So by the year 2030, 90% of tariffs on goods traded between these member states would have been abolished. And that's great news for what we can expect over the next 10 years from Africa.
I was having a look back through some of the many pieces that you've written about sub-Saharan Africa, and there was a great one from 2018 from CAPEX where there's a stat that really jumped out at me, which was that only 18% of exports from African countries were traded within the continent. Now that's compared to 69% for European countries and 59% for Asian countries. I assume that the African continental free trade area is designed to try and boost these figures.
Yeah, you're completely right. The intra-regional trade within Africa is tiny compared to Europe and Asia and even North America too. The United Nations Economic Commission to Africa has predicted the trade area will boost intra-regional trade by upwards of 52%. In just a few years' time, and once the final 10% of tariffs are removed, this 52% could then double again. And not only is this good as it increases trade, but when we look at the goods which are traded between African states, they're more likely to be higher value manufactured goods. And this is great news because when African states typically trade with the rest of the world, it tends to be commodities. So increasing the trade in manufactured goods does a lot to diversify their economic base of many countries. And this is good because currently about 3/4 of African countries rely on commodities for about 70% of their exports. And the problem with that is commodities, their prices can tend to fluctuate enormously. So if this intra-regional trade can diversify their exports, it can create a more stable business environment.
Is there any particular reason that the figures for exports within African countries are so low? Because I think people looking at it without any background would think it's easier, surely, to trade with your near neighbours than it is with the far side of the world. How come the African figures are so low?
Yeah, well, there's a few reasons. Firstly, there's enormous infrastructure problems. It's very hard to travel across Africa itself. Even when flying to Africa, if you travel from Accra to Nairobi, so from Ghana to Kenya, it's often actually easier to go up to Europe, get a connecting flight, and then head back down.
It's actually easier to fly from London to Johannesburg than it is from somewhere within Africa.
Often, and it's cheaper
and
to
cheaper.
Do so.
Wow, okay.
And then there's also, when it comes down to borders, because of quite a fair few closed borders or lots of tariffs to pay at the borders, that incentivizes corruption. It's not unheard of for delivery drivers to be waiting weeks at border points and often having to pay off and bribe officials in the process.
What does the future look like in terms of the UK's trading relationship with African nations post-Brexit? I mean, I was having a discussion with someone last week and they said that, you know, the UN estimates almost 20% of the world's population live in Africa. These are huge markets that the UK could be tapping into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's enormous potential going forward, and especially in the 2020s. If we look at current trends in Africa, the average incomes are set to increase from about 4,000 GDP per capita today to about 5,000 GDP, which is, of course, a tiny amount. 5,000 is a very small amount to live on. But if we look at a broader historical perspective, it took Western Europe over 34 years to get that same type of growth. It took from 1900 to 1934. So if Africa could make that 10, if Africa could do the same growth as Western Europe did in a 34-year period in 10 years, that'd be quite commendable. But what that means for the rest of the world is that sub-Saharan Africa's entire GDP will likely surpass $2.2 trillion, which will make it equal to the 8th largest economy in the world. And how that impacts especially Britain and Africa's relationship with the US is the free trade area is the plan is for it to become a customs union. And if it was to become a customs union, it would be far easier for British negotiators to trade with the African Free Trade Area as a bloc, as opposed to having to send negotiators to each individual African country or the different regional economic communities. So it would be easier to trade with in that regard. And this actually fits with America. A few years ago, they released a report saying how difficult they were finding it, having to send all these different trade expeditions to different countries, 55 different countries, and they wanted a way they could do it as a bloc. So this kind of resolves that problem. So it's not only easier for the British to negotiate trade after Brexit if they were to become a customs union. But to me, this was kind of secondary. The ease in which British can trade with Africa is, of course, important. But what excites me the most about the trade area is the impact it will have on the world's poorest people and their ability to flourish going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's quite natural for me to ask, oh, what are the benefits of the UK? But actually, what you're saying is that while the benefits are there, the benefits for the people living in sub-Saharan Africa being able to trade more easily within their own group of countries, those benefits are actually quite significant.
Yeah, absolutely. However, saying what I just said, it's important to remember that free trade is great, but free trade alone isn't enough. You need other things like strong rule of law and strong property rights, because without those, there's no real incentive for people to innovate, trade, take risks and start businesses in the first place. So free trade is amazing, but it needs to be contextualized in further reforms among quite a few of the African countries.
How many countries in sub-Saharan Africa would you say are already there when it comes to strong rule of law, property ownership, ownership rights, and how many have still got quite a long way to go?
So there's a fair few are getting there. Botswana, for example, has been doing incredible work over the last few years.
So Botswana is the one country in sub-Saharan Africa I do actually, my great aunt lived there, so that's the one country where I actually do, you know, I have some background knowledge in that area.
Oh, yeah, fantastic. Their incomes are pretty high compared to the rest of the continent. Their average incomes are about the same as, or slightly higher than Mexico and Turkey.
Yeah, which I think when you say that to people about a country in sub-Saharan Africa, people are quite surprised by that. But I should say that's down in no small part to a large quantity of diamonds that
yes.
can be found in Botswana.
Botswana is an interesting case study because they are doing very well, but they're also one of the most liberalized economies in that region. However, saying that, they do have a very small population and a lot of diamonds. And also, they're one of the few countries to escape the socialist dictatorship after independence, whereas yes. the entire region or the surrounding countries fell into that trap. So yeah.
It's a good example of you saying actually the political processes are as important as the sort of trade liberalization.
Yes, completely. However, what I think is fascinating is happening at the moment with the free trade area is that 60 years ago, this just couldn't have possibly been feasible. Post-independence, so many African countries took kind of a socialist route, and it all started in 1957 in Ghana with their leader, Kwame Nkrumah. He was the leader of the first independent African state after colonialism. And he was a self-proclaimed Marxian socialist, and he encouraged many other countries in the region to become independent in order so that they could pursue the complete ownership of the economy by the state. So many countries followed them, for example, Kieta in Mali, there's Tole in Guinea, Senghor in Senegal. And all these countries then, many of them saw colonialism and capitalism as one and the same. So because they fought colonialism was evil, and rightfully so, they assumed that capitalism was the same. And they all set up, many of these leaders set up what was called the Organization of African Unity in 1963 in order to push African socialism. But today, the successor of the Organization of African Unity is the African Union, which is now pushing free trade on a large scale. So even if this free trade area was unfortunately to fail, which I don't think it will, but if it does fail, it still shows a huge ideological shift from socialism just 50-60 years ago towards leaders pushing for free trade.
And those benefits are taking hold in sub-Saharan Africa much more quickly than, you know, people would have expected, all that Europe has done in the past. So we've looked at, you know, the last 20 years have been much better for Africa than people might think. What do the next 20 years look like? What are the major challenges to the free trade area, for example?
Yeah, so free trade area, there's absolutely tons of barriers to it, but they're slowly getting overcome. Recently, the Economist Intelligence Unit has predicted that the trade area will likely be delayed, even though it's going to be implemented in July this year. And part of the problem with this is only because 29 countries have ratified it. So there's still many more to go. As we, ideally, all 55 would ratify it. And that would create a huge contrast between different rules and regulations, which isn't ideal. And also Nigeria, which is the largest economy on the continent, equates to about 18% of the entire continent's GDP. They have signed the agreement, but they haven't ratified it. And many powerful people in Nigeria still remain opposed to it. Their trade unions, for example, the Trade Labour Congress, I believe it's called, they're one of the most powerful labour unions, and they've dubbed the free trade area as an evil neoliberal scheme. And they do hold a lot of power. So trying to popularise free trade amongst many of these governments and people on the ground is vital in the next 10, 20 years.
And we need to be really helping people to sell the benefits of free trade.
Yeah, absolutely. And to try and almost dispel a lot of the myths surrounding the free trade area, because it's the classic mercantilist myths which these opposition, these people opposed to the free trade area are pushing.
Okay, thanks very much. We're about to bring the podcast to an end, but I just want to ask on one question to end on. If there was one thing that you wish people knew about sub-Saharan Africa and when it comes to free trade, what do you wish was better understood?
So I think the main thing that should be better understood is that there's huge potential going forward for it. Everyone kind of hears that Africa is rising, but they imagine that 60, 70 years down the line. But the work that is done on the ground today is really going to set the foundation for in about 100 years' time when Africa, is, the continent, is probably going to be one of the world's largest economies. So the work now is crucially important to ensure that free trade, property rights, rule of law are adopted and adopted early on to ensure that future development and progress can be successful.
All right, Alex Hammond, Policy Advisor to the Director General here at the IEA. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Don't forget, you can let us know what you think about this or any other IEA podcast by tweeting us at IEA London. You can also subscribe to Live from Lord Northstreet through Spotify, Apple, or Podbean.